Making progress. We're in chapter 10. Turn around one day and it'll be over. See, I've entitled the message, if you have an outline, God the Meticulous Accountant. And we're continuing our study there. Remember last week, Job began to answer, or to speak at least after Bildad got through rebuking him. And Job begins to speak. And I don't know if you listened to the tape last week, but if you didn't, I'd encourage you to get it and to listen to the point that John made. That was, for me, one of the best sermons that we've had so far in the book of Job. Some good points. And I want to begin this morning by reading the text, and then we're going to kind of back up and do a little review. So if you're in Job chapter 10, let's begin reading in verse 1. Where Job, as he continues his speech from last week, he says, "My soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands, and smile on the counsel of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh, or do you see as man sees? Are your days like the days of a mortal man? Are your years like the days of a mighty man, that you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin? Although you know that I am not wicked, and there is no one who can deliver from your hand. Your hands have made me and fashioned me an intricate unity, yet you would destroy me. Remember, I pray, that you have made me like clay, and will you turn me into dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? You have granted me life and favor, and your care has preserved my spirit. And these things you have hidden in your heart, I know that this was with you. If I sin, you mark me, and will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I am wicked, woe to me. Even if I am righteous, I cannot lift up my head. I am full of disgrace. See my misery. If my head is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion. And again you show yourself awesome against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your indignation toward me. Changes and war are ever with me. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Oh, that I had perished and no eye had seen me. I would have been as though I had not been. I would have been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Cease, leave me alone, that I may take a little comfort before I go to the place from which I shall not return, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, a land as dark as darkness itself, as the shadow of death without any order, where even the light is like darkness." So we can see from the content there that Job is continuing pretty much down the same road in a way that he has been going. I want us to review just for a minute. I hope you have an outline, because we're going to kind of have a little interaction here. The five actors in this drama, five principal actors. First one is Satan. Second one is God. Third one, Job. The fourth one, the three friends, kind of lump them together as a group. The three friends of Job. And the fifth one, Job's wife. So think of those five people. And I'll ask this question: who of these five, or how many of these five, believes the following statements? The first statement is this: that Job is generally righteous. Now let me explain to you what I mean by generally righteous. When I say that, I mean that Job, there's not some glaring evil that Job is harboring in his heart. There's not some glaring evil that Job is participating in. Sure, Job is a sinner. Job is not perfect. Job is not sinless. Yet Job keeps short accounts with God. Job is mindful of his sin. And Job confesses his sin regularly and has a deep desire to live righteous. That's what I mean when I use that statement. Job is generally righteous. Who of those five groups believes that to be true? Let's start out. Satan. Does Satan believe that to be true? That Job is generally righteous? I think so. All right. What about God? Yes, God said so, right? What about Job? I think Job thinks he's generally a pretty good guy, you know. What about Job's three friends? Don't think so. Don't think so. They may have used to. Okay, let's give the disclaimer there. I can't hardly see how they could not have used to have seen that because of the things that they said about Job. You remember talked about how Job helped other people? But now that all of this stuff has come upon Job, and we want to answer these questions in the light of today in Job's life, okay? But I think they've changed their mind because of the things that's happened to Job. What about Job's wife? Does Job's wife think that Job is generally righteous? I think so. She says, Job, why do you retain your integrity? Why do you hang on to your integrity? It implies that she believes that. Although we have, just remember that two sentences from her in the whole book, we conclude a lot of things from those two sentences about her. But I think so. So I think all of those generally think Job is righteous at this moment, except his three friends. The second question, God is perfectly just. Does Satan think God is perfectly just? I think so. I think Satan knows that God is a just God, perfectly just. That doesn't mean he doesn't hate him. You can hate someone who is perfectly just because you are evil. What about God? Does God think God is perfectly just? Like so? He knows so. What about Job? Does Job think God is perfectly just? Okay, we're back to that thing used to in nowadays, right? Okay, he's beginning to question it, isn't he? He's beginning to wonder. He's beginning to express some doubts that what God is doing is just. What about Job's three friends? Do they think God is perfectly just? Yes, they do. What about Job's wife? Probably not. She's kind of perhaps in the same, well, we really don't know prior to that, but she may be in the same category with Job to some extent. The next statement, for every sin, there is a judgment, and I don't know if that's the best word. You may put punishment in there. For every sin, there is a punishment. For every punishment, there was a sin. Everybody understand the perfect parallel there? That's sort of reversed. For every sin, there's a punishment. For every punishment or every bad experience that you face in your life, there was a sin that was the cause of it. Does God believe that? Well, we're supposed to start with Satan. Does Satan believe that? I don't think so. He's asking God to do something that's contrary to that, isn't he? What about God? Does God believe that? No. God knows God can do, let people experience bad things for no particular punishment for sin, but for His own glory. We see that in the Scriptures. What about Job? Does Job believe for every sin there's a judgment? For every judgment there's a sin? He used to, but now he doesn't think so. He thinks he's experiencing judgment and punishment, then there's no cause for it. What about Job's three friends? They still hanging on to that, aren't they? All right, the tragedy is not on their ash heap. It's on Job's, right? What about Job's wife? Okay? I don't think so. I don't think so. Well, she may. It's hard for me to answer that question very definitively. The last statement, this is a new one. And this comes from John's sermon last week. This statement, God is sovereign. Does Satan believe that God is sovereign? Yes, he does. Does God believe he is himself a sovereign? Does Job believe God is sovereign? Does Job's three friends believe God is sovereign? Does Job's wife believe God is sovereign? Every one of those five, I think we can have y'all seem to have easily concluded that they all believe God is sovereign. And I hope I'm not misstating what I felt was John's main point last week. But it seemed to me John was making the point that Job cannot let go of that idea. God is sovereign. Job, no matter how much he's struggling, no matter how much he's suffering, he can't let go of that truth and say, I don't believe it. He thinks God is sovereign. I'm going to tell you, that flies in the face of much of the belief of current Christianity in the world. Much of what goes under the auspices of Christianity has let go of that truth, that God is sovereign. But in all that Job has experienced, he can't do it. He can't do it. And yet, he believes that God is sovereign, and that if God wants to make your life miserable for no apparent reason, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Now, Job is hurting. Job is thinking, is going every which direction, trying to make sense of all this. And that seemed to be part of what Job was saying last week. There is nothing I can do about it. God, you'll do what you want to do. No matter how much I plead or beg or try to get you to explain yourself, if you want to do it for just no reason, you'll do it, can do it, because you're a sovereign God. Last week, Job, as before, it seems, had just been talking. He wasn't talking to God. He wasn't necessarily, I don't think, talking to his friends. He was just venting. He's done that before. He'll do it again. And yet today, like the other times, his venting and his expressing himself orally out loud turns and eventually begins to speak and express himself to God. And that's where we're at in chapter 10. As this dialogue begins, Job begins to address God. You see five things. Let's look at them. The first one. We are willing to take great risk with what we value but little. Now you could look at that in a financial standpoint. Someone who has a boat's load of money and they don't place a whole lot of value on money, doesn't bother them to take great risk. They got plenty to lose. All right? I could take great risk with all the rocks around my place because I've got so many, I don't hold them to much value. So if you want something, you don't trade me for rocks, well, you can get a good deal. You can get lots of rocks. We're willing to take great risk with something we value little. At Job, at this point in his life, what is it that he values little? His life. His life. He says in verse 1, my soul loathes my life. And he's willing to take great risk with his life because he values his life so little. The great risk that he is willing to take is mouthing off. He says, my soul loathes my life, therefore I'll just say what I want to say. I'll give free course to my complaint. He asked God, I don't know, I got on here for the last time or one last time. I don't know if it's the last time. We'll see. God again, but he pleads to God, show me. Tell me why this is going on. Tell me why this is happening. Notice what he says in verse 3. Does it seem good to you? Now, he's going to make a comparison between two things, and I want you to identify what the two things are. He asks God, he says, does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked? Two things he's contrasting. He's contrasting two actions or attitudes of God. One is something God despises. And the other contrasting attitude from God is something that God smiles upon. He says, God, on the one hand, you despise A, and you smile upon B. See the contrasting attitudes he's pointing out in God? What are the two things that God is despising and smiling on from these verses? You despise what? The work of your hand. See in verse 3, why would you despise the work of your hand and smile upon what? The wicked. Now, how does that apply to Job? In this case, what is Job implying is the work of God's hand. Himself. That's it. His own life. Because he's seeing that's what God apparently appears to be despising at this moment, right? So he says, God, can you explain to me how you would despise my life and yet condone or smile upon the activity of the wicked? I don't think there's any, for that we know of, any particular wicked things or people that Job has in mind, but he could probably name a bunch. We all could name plenty of wicked people that it seems God is smiling upon. They seem to be prospering. Things seem to be going well. But again, we see here Job placing himself in that group of people that were great works of God's hand. Good things. I don't think Job is horribly misplaced with that statement. I don't think it's an awful thing necessarily to recognize that my life might be at least a little bit more righteous than Adolf Hitler's was. It's not necessarily looking upon myself with better intentions than I ought. Job is saying, God, can you tell me? Can you tell me why you have looked upon me and despised me in such a way, and yet I see wicked people prospering? Job is being bold. Not the first time that we've seen that from Job in this book. It won't be the last. That's the first point. We're willing to take great risk with what you value but little. Second point is this. Maybe God's actions are because he is more like a man than I thought. So here Job suggests to God. He asks God three or four questions. And the gist of the questions seem to be that, God, are you really not like I thought God was? Are you like me? Are you like men? He says, do you have eyes of flesh? Do you see as a man sees? What's the idea there? What's the implications? When we see things, we are prone to miss-see, aren't we? We're prone to see things not as they really are. We can't see below the surface. We can't see everything that we think we see. Sometimes we think we know what's going on in a situation and we don't. That's why there's a proverb. I don't know why there's a proverb, but there's a proverb that speaks to that. A man that is hasty in his speech, right? Don't answer a matter before you hear it. Don't speak too quick about judgment something till you know all the facts. Job is asking God, do you see like man sees? When you're looking at my life and condemning me and bringing all this upon me in judgment, you reckon there's a possibility that you're wrong? That you're just like other men? You cannot know all the facts? He asked him another question. Are your days numbered like a man's? Is your lifespan so short? Now this is an interesting thought that I think I'm going to kind of paraphrase what I think Job is saying. He says, God, it seems like that you've just been sitting around waiting for me to screw up so you can pin my hide to the wall. And you've looked and looked and waited and waited and waited and it hasn't happened. So you have to, and because perhaps your life is so short, just like a man's life, you've got to hurry up and find something. So you go to looking. You're not just waiting for me to do it. You start looking for something wrong, trying to find something wrong with me. He says, you know you can't find anything. You know I have done nothing wrong. He says, what verse is that? 7. Although you know I am not wicked, you can't find anything wrong, but you still hammer me with this judgment, and you know there is nobody on this earth that can call you down. Back to the idea that you're sovereign. Point number 3. Job says, my life till now has only been a gracious work of your hand at every turn. My life up till now has only been a gracious work of your hand at every turn. And these verses, verses 8 to 12, Job seems to be soft. Job seems to be softening, perhaps I should say. Job seems to be remembering something that I think is important. It seems to me like that Job seems sincere. It seems to me like Job seems to be remembering what he has always been quick to acknowledge. That his life, the gracious life that God has given him, has come from the gracious hand of God. Notice what he says. Your hands have made me. Your hands have fashioned me. I'm an intricate unity. Remember, I pray that you made me like clay. I'm not reading the rest of each of those verses because he's saying, now would you turn me into dust again? But notice what he's saying that God has done. Did you not pour me out like milk? And that's not, and he says, and curdle me like cheese. I don't think that's a negative thing that God just stirred him up. I think he's talking about God's purposes. People pour milk into a churn, and I don't know how they do it. It was before my time. But it's a purpose to it. There's a purpose to the churning to make something useful. I think that's his idea. It's a positive thing. God, did you not, just like you would making cheese and butter out of milk, did you not do that with my life? You did. You did that with my life. You clothed me with skin and flesh. You knit my skin together with bones and sinew. You granted me life and favor. And your care has preserved my spirit. Job is acknowledging that all of the good things he has experienced before this time has come from God's hand. And I don't think that this is the first time that has occurred to him. I think that this is part of the reason, perhaps, that God had blessed him. It was because he did not take credit for the blessings and the good things that God had given to him. I'll never forget, I'm not much of a, don't know a whole lot about remembering movies, but the first time I watched part of the movie Shenandoah, y'all remember that movie, Jimmy Stewart? Remember how Jimmy Stewart prayed at the dinner table? It wasn't really a prayer. He was just reciting off all the wonderful things he had done. How hard he'd worked. You remember that? God, we cleared the field. We brought in the cows. We did this. We did that. And now we're going to eat. All right, that's not much of a blessing on the food. It wasn't Job's attitude, I don't think. It doesn't seem like that was the way Job had lived his life prior to this point. It seems like Job was very aware that all that he had in his possessions was come from the gracious hand of a good God. And I have a feeling that Job had been accustomed to acknowledging that regularly. It seemed to come so easily off his tongue now as he remembered all those things. But let's go on. Number four. We're going to park here for a little while. God is more parent than grandparent. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. You already know. I have, to some extent, it seems like, in my physical health, an intolerance to dairy products. On the other hand, there's Bluebell homemade ice cream. And there's not much better than late at night eating a bowl of Bluebell homemade vanilla ice cream before you go to bed. But about 3 out of 10 times that I do that, I'll wake up about 5 o'clock the next morning, my stomach cramping pretty good. About 3 out of 10. And I'll buy a half gallon of ice cream, and I'll eat a bowl, a nice size bowl, every night until it's gone. And by the time, that ain't but about 4 or 5 bowls. I have pretty good bowls. And by the end of those 4 or 5 nights, I'm starting to wake up cramping every morning. I'll tell Susan, I'll say, "Don't buy me any more ice cream." She didn't buy that, I did. Okay? And she'll say, "Yeah, sure." I'll say, "I'm finished with it. I'm not eating anymore." And that'll last about a month. I bought some yesterday, in fact, in preparation for this sermon. for your benefit. Not yet. I didn't eat any last night. But here's what happens. After a month of being off, I'm thinking about the 7 times it didn't bother me. Okay? I'm not thinking about the 3 times it did. Now, you haven't asked for any parenting advice, but I'm going to give you a little bit. I think that the discipline, and this was kind of my philosophy growing up, I'm sure Susan Mark Dan could vouch for this, is that if a child is punished every time they disobey, that very quickly they will learn, this is going to happen every time. We see parents who will say, "This is the punishment for this crime or this, you know, this misbehavior," and the child will misbehave and there's no punishment. It's not meted out. And it's meted out maybe 1 out of 10 times. Right? And then all those times they're just chaos, there's turmoil. Because the child learns what I know about Bluebell ice cream. That 9 out of 10 times he's going to get away with it. Years ago, we had a 3-year-old girl come into our life, come into our family. not the fault of the three-year-old girl, but she had absolutely no discipline, no training. I remember we went out to eat at a restaurant, and it was a war. And I told Susan when we left, I said, I'll never go out to eat with them again. Not like that. It was awful. It ruined not only our meal, but everybody within 20 foot. Right? At our house. And they were going to be eating three meals a day with us for several months. I knew that. And every meal was a war. A war. In between meals, she ate nothing but potato chips. And at mealtime, I mean lots of potato chips. And at mealtime, it was a war. And I told Seth, I said, we're not doing this. We're not going to do this way. And so I told her mother, I can fix this, I believe. First of all, you don't pile so much more food on her plate than even I could eat. All right? So put enough food on her plate, something I knew she liked, just enough that she could have success in cleaning her plate. A little bit, just a little bit. And then I told her, I said, you're going to eat. And if you don't eat, I'm going to go to the bedroom and I'm going to spank you. And I already had me a switch. It was about just a little limb off of a little tree, smaller than a pencil. I mean, I could have broke it. You know, it wasn't going to hurt her, but it would sting on the back of your thighs, like sting really good. About that long, I had it there. So if you don't eat, here's the punishment. First time that you start making a stink, I'm going to the bedroom. Well, you know, she has to try it out. So we go to the bedroom, and I warm her legs up. And I told her, I said, I hugged her. I said, we're going back in there. And you're going to sit down, and we're going to eat. If you don't eat, we're coming back. We're going to do this however how many times it takes until you eat. And not fight, not scream, not cry. You know how many times I had to whip her? One. One time. The wars were over. They were gone too. That was part of the deal. No eating between meals.
Yeah.
A few years later, two brothers have come along. And again, we're in a situation where they're going to be staying with us, and you don't need to know. If you can't figure it out, I'll tell you after church. On come these other kids, and they're going to be staying in my house. And here's the key. In these situations, my role was not Papa. My role was Daddy. I wasn't the daddy, but I was serving that purpose because they were staying at my house. Okay? That's an important distinction. So here come these two little boys. Not eating issues, but other issues. Took them three or four times. Figure out, hey, every time I do this, Papa's going to warm my butt. They figured it out, and it's the end. Okay? All that is gone now. It's gone. And I am transitioning, and Susan as well, from the role of acting as the role as a parent to a grandparent. Mm-hmm. And that's different. Okay? When my boys were small, and they did something, broke something, whatever, and lied about it. I said, who did this? No, nobody did it. You know? My socket set is out of my toolbox and then scattered over in the front yard. Who did that? Nobody did it. All right, just walked out of the truck and got out in the front yard. When they were boys, that called for a criminal investigation. All right, I was not content until I solved that lie. Okay, I felt it was important that they did not get away with lying. My grandkids can leave my shovel out in the woods. Who did that? Oh, nobody knows who left scared your tools out there. You know what I do? I laugh. I say, somebody's lying. Somebody's lying, you know, blow it off. Susan tells the story of her grandparents, her mom's parents. Her grandpa's name Fred, his wife's name Verbal. And Susan says, I can remember this. I've heard this story two or three times when I was a little kid. And I don't know how old she was, probably anywhere from 3 to 16 probably, but probably 4 or 5 years old. And she said, I go to their house, and I guess every grandkid does this. I can remember doing it to some extent. And they start what we call pilfering. And it's not taking stuff. It's just checking things out, you know. And she says, I'd open every drawer in the house. She said, I knew what was in every drawer in the house, all over the place. And every time I went, I had to check it all out again, you know. And she played with things that her grandma ordinarily wouldn't have wanted to be playing with. And she said, I can remember Pawpaw, Fred, sitting over there, and he said, and you'd have to, Daniel could impersonate him. I ought to have him come up and impersonate him. But Fred would be over there saying, now, Verbal, you don't need to do that. Verbal, you don't need to do that. And she said, I remember Nanny. Verbal said, Fred, just be quiet. It's right. Everything's okay. All right. Grandma. Now, when Susan, when our kids were small, kept things put up that she didn't want the boys when they were young playing with. They were put up, okay? Now, with the grandkids, they can play with some porcelain figurine that come over on the Mayflower, you know, seven generations ago, and it's okay. Job is saying, God, you're like a parent. All this time, you have blessed me, and I enjoyed your blessings. But all along, I find out now that all along, you were like a meticulous accountant. You were keeping track of everything I did wrong. You had it all in your record book. You knew all the stuff I had done. And so far you hadn't hit me with it, but now apparently you have. You decided to lower the boom on me. And if I even so much as pop my head up, you whack it off. That seems to be what Job is saying. Notice in verse 13, and these things, the things prior to that, which is where he's reciting how God has blessed him, all these things that you blessed me with and you formed me and you made me and you prospered me, he says you hid them somewhere deep away in your heart where you can't think about them. And when I sin, you mark me. You make a note of it. Job sinned. You will not acquit me of my iniquity. You're not going to overlook it. You're going to remember it, and someday I'm going to pay account for it. If I'm wicked, woe to me. If I'm righteous, I can't even lift up my head. I'm full of disgrace. My head is lifted up. You hit me and hunt me like a fierce lion. You show yourself awesome against me. You renew your witnesses against me. You remember all those things. You have the witnesses to prove your point, to back your story up. He says, my life is nothing but a war. I'm nothing but just troubled on every hand because I have to constantly watch my back to see when you're going to strike me. Robert Louis Stevenson. Everybody know who that is? What did he write? Treasure Island, okay. Anybody know anything else you wrote? Huh? Good poems, okay. I thought I remembered Treasure Island, right? I'm going to read you something. Robert Louis Stevenson, he lived from 1850 to 1894. Died when he was 44 years old. He wrote and had an unfinished novel. I'm assuming, and this is just my assumption, that if he died when he was 44, that's probably why it's unfinished. He probably died, you know, at a young age and didn't finish it. But the novel's called The Weir of Hermiston. W-E-I-R. Is that how you say that, weir? Anybody know what a weir is? Carol, you're the Scrabble player. I had to look it up, so I'm not, I've known this for about 12 hours. A weir is some type of trap, usually in the water, that you use to catch and fish, you know, in a certain area where you can get to them later. They can't get away. Some type of weir. So it's an encroachment or a cage type thing where the fish can get in, but they can't get out. And you can get them anytime you want to. What did you say, John? Minnebucket would be a good example of that, okay? So the name of the book was The Weir of Hermiston, and Hermiston was a judge. And this judge has in his court, the judge has the reputation of the hanging judge, sort of like Isaac Parker in Fort Smith, in this book. All right? And he has this wretch of a man named Duncan Jopp is on trial for his life. Now it doesn't tell us if Duncan Jopp was a wicked, evil, murdering criminal, or if he was just a vagabond, just a petty thief. But you get the idea from the little bit that he tells you about the book, that it could have just as easily been the petty thief variety, and yet he's on trial for his life in this Judge Lord Hermiston's court. Now, notice I'm going to read a paragraph from this unfinished novel. Now, if you're like me, your vocabulary has been dumbed down over the last few years, and it may be a little hard to follow. Now, this is when people had a little better vocabulary than we do nowadays. Here's what he says. Over against him, or against, you know, opposite Duncan Jopp, the criminal, was this Lord Hermiston. He says, over against him, my Lord Hermiston occupied the bench in the red robes of criminal jurisdiction, his face framed in the white wig. Honest all through, he did not affect the virtue of impartiality. This was no case for refinement. There was a man to be hanged, he would have said, and he was hanging him. Nor was it possible to see his lordship and acquit him of gusto in the task. It was plain he gloried in the exercise of his trained faculties, in the clear sight which pierced at once into the joint of fact, in the rude, unvarnished jibes with which he demolished every figment of defense. The rag of man with the flannel around his neck was hunted gallowsward with jeers. And I'm not sure what I just read, but I think the general gist was that Lord Hermiston delighted in passing judgment on his subjects. Now, that seems to be the accusation that Job is leveling toward God. God, you take great delight in judging me. You're getting your jollies out of it. Then the last point, please. Just a little relief before I die. He says, this is in verse 18 to 22. He says, why can't you just leave me alone just for a bit? Just for a little bit, turn and bother somebody else. Look the other way. Give me just a little relief that I might die in some just small measure of peace. And the chapter ends. Let's pray. Father, I would like to think that I would not behave like this, that I would not say such things. But God, I think that's asking way too much. Lord, I know how I get with just the slightest discomforts. And were you to turn your hand against me, even the slightest for my iniquities, I'm afraid I would be just like Job, maybe worse. God, we thank you for your grace. Thank you for your mercy. It is indeed new every morning. God, teach us from your word. Amen.